Hey guys, did you know that you can subscribe to the Investor Coaching Show podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts? When you subscribe, you get notifications with new episodes so you never have to go looking for an episode or worry about what you've missed. So if you're on your phone or computer, go ahead and pause the episode real quick and become a subscriber. If you're not sure how to subscribe, go to paulwinkler.com/how-to-subscribe, all one word, how to subscribe, for instructions, or click the link in the show note. Now let's get started.
Welcome to the Investor Coaching Show, a podcast to help you get an insider's view of the financial world and escape common investment traps. We look at the financial news of the day and help you make sense of it so you can relax about money. And here's your host, Paul Winkler.
All right, so Brian in our office has been doing a tremendous amount of research, so I'm going to give him some kudos for this research, because I said, hey, you need to do some research, man, for me. I want you to look into something, because I got this idea, you know, because people quite often ask me, because they see so much marketing, they don't think it's marketing, they think it's, you know,
advice.
They think it's advice, or they think, yeah, they think it's good advice from the media who gave you, you need to buy tech stocks in the late 90s.
Right.
You need to buy oil stocks in the mid-2000s. You need to buy housing just before housing crashed. You know, this, the media is, they're really good at giving advice. I always get a kick out of it. And the mutual fund companies that were really, really hot, that everybody just knew that you had to have. Every decade, it's different.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now it's just certain companies that are out there and they have great marketing and they are written about a lot in the media. And people ask us about it all the time. And I thought, hey, let's do a little bit of a segment on why don't we use those companies? Because we're basically free to do whatever we want, you know, as far as, well, not free to do whatever we want. And we, you know, we have to have a fiduciary responsibility to our clients, but it doesn't, you know, whichever fund companies we feel like using for whatever purposes, for whatever asset class we can use, because we aren't tied to any particular investment firm. We're not tied to a broker dealer. We're not tied to, you know, when you see broker dealer, like, you know, investments provided through, and they'll have a brokerage firm that they work for. It's back when I used to work for a large insurance company. My job was to sell the products of that insurance company. Then I worked for another insurance company. Then I worked for another broker dealer. And my job, they give you a list, right, Ira?
That's correct.
A list of all the funds and things that you can recommend, because we have agreements with these funds.
Well, I used to have managers asking me, why wasn't I selling the funds that were provided by the company itself with the company's name on it? Well, actually, I could say it because they're no longer in business.
Yeah, Shearson Lehman.
Shearson Lehman Brothers.
Right.
They were, why aren't you selling the Shearson Lehman Brothers funds?
Mm-hmm.
And I would tell them, I don't want my clients to think that I'm selling it just because I work for this firm.
Well, yeah.
And I wanted to be objective.
And they would do that. You know, even the big insurance company would have other insurance companies you could sell, but there were great incentives to selling the particular funds that the insurance company was backed by.
Oh, they used to actually put more money. If I sold a Shearson fund,
right,
or a Smith Barney fund when I was with them, they would actually bonus more money into our deferred comp plans.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Than if I sold an outside Fidelity fund.
Yeah,
because we used to be able to sell Fidelity.
Sure.
So.
Sure. And you know, and they would do that. And the other thing that they would do is, you know, just the general commissions, the payouts, typically higher, you know, the percentage of payout to the advisor.
Well, when I was with Shearson, that they didn't make the payout higher.
Oh, they didn't change the
not
payout.
Not for the Shearson fund.
They did for the company I was with.
But they did it inside of the deferred comp.
Right, and you have revenue sharing arrangements, and there are still companies, and I do this with people, with very, very big brokerage firms, and I'll go and they'll ask me about it, and they'll say, well, what do you think of this? And I'll say, well, let's go look at the disclosures page. And I'll dig in and say, well, here, you got to click here. Then you click here. Then you click here on their website. Then you click here. And then you click here. And then if you read down to the fourth paragraph, you'll see.
Right.
Yeah, they disclosed it. All right.
The company may have a conflict of interest with its investors.
Yeah. So so one of the questions that quite often comes up is, you know, Paul, you know, why you guys don't recommend Vanguard or Fidelity or use them in your investment portfolios? And really, a lot of it comes down to philosophically, you know, the differences. And it's not, you know, if they came out with something I thought was decent, I would recommend it. But people, a lot of times when they're using fund companies, either in the workplace, and there are okay funds at any of these fund companies, but a lot of asset categories are really hard to capture at a typical fund company. And really comes down to this. One of the reasons is because they typically, if they do an indexing approach, they capitalization weight, which in English, you've heard me say this before, if you listen to the show frame, length of time, they overweight big companies. Well, where do we expect more return? Small companies. They overweight growth companies. Where do we expect more return? Value companies. And why they do that is because visibly the expenses are lower. It's a lot cheaper to manage a portfolio when you capitalization weight it than when you actually weight it based on the factors, which is what I talk about, you know, small versus large, value versus growth, and manage a portfolio in that particular manner. Now, a lot of times, if you're using an asset class approach to investing, you'll take the index. You might start with that, but you'll subtract real estate investment trusts, limited partnerships, IPOs, companies near bankruptcy. There are a lot of things that don't fit. Like real estate, you don't want in a stock portfolio, so you want to remove that from the portfolio. You don't want to have IPOs in there because IPOs, initial public offerings, tend to lose money in the first 9 months. Yeah, so there are a lot of reasons that you do that. But what I had Brian do, and I said, okay, so just go out there and just, because philosophically, I want to make this point. If I invest, for example, in like large U.S. stocks, well, there are a lot of different funds out there in large U.S. stocks. Like Vanguard has 17 funds that invest in large U.S. stocks, large U.S. blend stocks. Okay, which one? Which one do I choose out of those? Now, why are there so many different choices? Fidelity, it's even higher. It's 43. Why do I have so many choices? Well, there's a game that fund companies play. And American Funds would be another fund. You know, they're companies that do the same exact thing. Lots of fund companies. So I'm not just picking on these two companies. But what they'll do is they'll have a lot of different funds. And then one of those funds will outperform the others. There'll be some fund that all, and when I would go to broker-dealer conferences, it was American Funds, and they would say, hey, this fund manager is coming to talk to us today, and I would be at the conference, and this person would come in, and the next year at the same conference, they would have a different manager. Well, what happened to last year's manager? Well, he didn't have such a great year. He underperformed this past year. I said, well, wait a minute. Was his performance in the previous year due to luck, or was it skill? is the question that you have to ask yourself. Why didn't they perform well again? What happened there? And that's when I started to get a sneaking suspicion that maybe the world wasn't as what it appeared to be, you know, because the fund managers would change every single year. And you'd have this lack of persistency is what it was called. And we'd just be shaking our heads going, what on earth is going on here? So, you know, if you look at, they see the sheer number of funds. Now, the other thing is this. If you look at companies and you look at performance in the past few years, growth companies have done better than value companies. So I've called this the perfect storm. The perfect storm is that you have the area of the market that people are most familiar with, large U.S. growth companies, big, well-known, well-liked, well-thought-of companies everybody does business with, having an outperformance for a period of time. And what people do is they do, I've done a lot of research about investing. Oh, what kind of research have you done? Well, I've been reading an awful lot about areas of the market, funds that I should be investing in, what funds have done better than others. And you would end up with a portfolio of one area of the market predominantly over the past 5 years. If we look at this, we say, okay, so that area of the market has done super, super well. And if we look at the price to book of that area of the market, we hear people say it's overvalued, right? Overvalued area of the market right now. Some people are saying, other people are chasing it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you don't see that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Not much.
Yeah, not ever, like always. I mean, when you analyze a portfolio, how often is it that large U.S. is not overweighted versus everything else?
Oh, it's always overweighted.
I can't think of an instance.
No,
I can't think of one.
I have not seen a portfolio in and let me
decades.
Just say in the 13, little over 13 years I'm working here.
Yeah.
I have not seen a portfolio that is underweighted in launch.
Yeah.
And weighted in the areas of the market that actually have higher rates of return. They're actually always weighted in large growth.
Right. Which historically would have the lowest long-term expected return because they don't have to pay as much to use your money historically.
Right.
But you can have periods of time like the last 5 years where they did better.
Yeah, and
because of like COVID and you know things like that,
and that's where a lot of the problems you know really lie.
Yeah,
because as an investor looking where to invest, typically investors are going to look and say, okay, well, what has recently done well?
Sure.
So let me put my money there.
And what's recent to them?
Right.
5, 10 years.
Uh huh.
You know, even 20 years is too short.
I don't even think most investors look back 10 years.
Yeah, probably not. But I'm even saying you're right. I think I've actually seen data and research that says that they do tend to gravitate toward 5 years. 5 years, there's a psychological bias to 5 years.
And if you look at most of the funds in 401k plans, when you look at what's available in their lineup, if they happen to have a portfolio that is not overly weighted with target date funds, mm-hmm. and they still have individual funds, you'll see a lot of funds, they don't even have a 10-year history because of how often the funds in the 401k plan are turned over.
Oh, sure.
So they may have 3, they may have 5, they may be in there for 7, but for the most part, all the information and data regarding the funds that are available in the plan are 1, 3, 5, and 10-year periods.
No question.
So you can't even look back 10 years for most investors.
And why is this so short? Well, the reason being that fund they added to the portfolio, it doesn't perform the way they thought it would, and they get rid of it and they change to something else.
Another thing that I find too is that most investors, it seems to me, don't really become very serious about the way they're investing mm-hmm. until they hit about the 50-year age mark.
I find that to be very true.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think it's because they realize that, they're 15 years away from retirement mm-hmm. and they don't have as much time to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, they're beginning to become more interested in what's really going on in their portfolio.
And sometimes it actually drives them to mistakes, though, because they actually want to play catch up.
That's, and I find that a lot, where clients will say to me, a 55-year-old, say, well, I only have 10 years to make up and get where I should be, so I'm willing to be more aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
Where
mm-hmm.
I'll say, well, that's really not the way to do it.
Yeah, and then they're taking risks that they're not compensated for.
Well, the problem that I see is, and I remember going back to 2011,
mm-hmm.
or, 2011, where people would come into us and, I would sit down with them and they would say, I was hoping to retire in 2012, but what's happened with my portfolio, I'm not going to have enough money to do it.
Right, because 08 was such a hit.
Right.
Yeah.
And having just turned 60, in February, I put my portfolio, I've been in a 95% stock portfolio mm-hmm. all the years,
mm-hmm.
and I just set my portfolio up on something that we do where my risk is slowly going to get less.
So you're doing stock. Frontier adjustment.
The frontier adjustment.
What it's called, yeah.
The
mm-hmm.
stock is going to be decreasing in value or in percentages,
percentages
over the
sure.
next 10 years
mm-hmm.
because I don't want to get to 68 years of age. Not that I plan to retire, but let's just say, I just know I want to have I have a knowledge of the basic amount of money I want to have in my investment accounts mm-hmm. at the age of 70.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not
target.
That I plan to retire, but knowing that I could if I wanted would be a great feeling.
Which is what I tell people, the people that say, I'm never going to retire. Well, you may have to retire. You may have health issues. You may have family with health issues. You
right.
may have, there may be changes in priority,
Right. So the stock in my portfolio as a percentage over the next 10 years will be decreasing.
Mm-hmm.
Where a lot of, guys are saying, oh, well, I got 5 more years. I'm 60 years old. I only got 5 years to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to be more aggressive. No, now is not the time to be more aggressive.
Right. Well, that's what I meant by uncompensated risk, because mm-hmm. people take risks and they think I'm going to get paid more. That's not necessarily true. There are a lot of risks that you can take that you're not compensated for. One I use as an example, it's in my book. I'm standing on a wing on a biplane rather than sitting in the seat. Am I taking a risk? Yes, I am. Am I likely to get to the destination faster? Only if the plane stops and I fly off the front of it, if they can stop midair. And maybe the force of gravity pulls me to the destination faster. No, all kidding aside, the reality of it is there are lots of risks that I could stand on a hill during a lightning storm with a 9-iron. Am I taking a risk? Yes. Am I likely to get compensated in any meaningful positive way doing that? No, probably not.
Well, here's a
but investing in options contracts, investing in market timing, in engaging in market timing, engaging in stock picking. Am I taking a risk? Yes. Is there an expected extra return to be had from that? No, there's not. That's what I meant by uncompensated risk.
Well, a very good analogy that I use when I'm teaching my clients is, if I'm only going 10 miles down the road, mm-hmm. and I'm running late for an appointment,
right?
Driving 90 miles an hour is not going to get me there that much quicker.
And it may you get know? You a ticket and get you in an accident.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's a risk that I'm not getting compensated for, because I'm not going to get to that destination 10 miles down the road that much sooner.
Right.
I even did it using, my mom's house in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
It's 868 miles mm-hmm. from my door to my mom's door.
Mm-hmm.
And going 78 miles an hour, more than likely I'm not going to get stopped by a cop. But going 82 miles an hour
right.
will only get me to her place 20 minutes earlier,
mm-hmm.
not barring, having to stop for gas or anything else, just the time-wise and miles per hour. So that 20 minutes is not enough of a compensation
mm-hmm.
for the potential ticket that I might get going 82, just 4 miles an hour faster than 78.
Right, exactly.
And the cops are going to probably waste at least 20 minutes of my time, and then the ticket I might have to pay.
If not many times during that period of time. You may get not pulled over just once, but it may be many times, and that because it's a long trip. Yeah, so we're talking about these two fund companies, and I just used one asset category. That's all I've done so far is one asset category, which is large U.S. stocks. Now, if you look at the statistics of all the funds that they said, I said Vanguard had 17 funds in that area of the market, 43 for Fidelity. And if you look at what has caused that area of the market to do well recently, it has been a lot of things that are not likely repeatable. For example, we're not likely to have a scenario where we have a president that comes in and does a lot of tariffs on China. Matter of fact, the newest president is not doing the same types of activities that the last president was doing. And of course, because of that and because of the pandemic and all of those things, that area of the market was compensated and did very, very well during that period of time. So what would that do to the price of those companies? It would make the price very high compared to the assets of the companies. So we look at what price they're selling for compared to book value. If we look at a company and we say the price is higher compared to its book value, this assets, then its likelihood of growing even further and exceeding the book value by even more is kind of hard to fathom. Because, trees don't grow to heaven. Well, if you look at the S&P 500 right now, or large U.S. stocks in general, that area of the market's selling for about $4.43. Historic norm, $2.40, just to put it in perspective. Vanguard's funds that are in that area of the market, $6.26. That's their average price to book for funds that are investing in that area of the market. So you look at that and go, whoa, that's pretty doggone high. Fidelity, $5.86. So if we look at these companies and we say, wow, okay, so in essence, I've got that. Now, how about turnover ratios? The turnover ratio on a fund investing in that area of the market, if I have 100% turnover, that means 100% of the stocks are different. If I have 20% turnover, 20% of the stocks are different from one year to the next. More buying and selling is going to show up in turnover ratio. That means that they're gambling with the portfolio more, buying and selling, trading, if we see higher turnover. If we look at Vanguard, it's 14%. Fidelity is 49%. So in essence, what should it be? Somewhere in the neighborhood of less than 5. Okay, so in essence, we see much greater buying and selling going on in the portfolio. Now, some of those funds that are included in that have low buying and selling. Some have higher. So that's the average of all of them, right? That average is going to have, some of your funds are going to be higher, some are going to be lower than the average, right? By definition, right? So if we look at this and we say, oh, okay, so we've got a lot of different funds, and some of them have really, really high turnover and some don't have much. What's that telling us about the fund company? That they have philosophically decided to have their foot on both the boat and the dock, if you think about it that way. They are playing two sides of the coin. And it would be like a doctor saying, hey, you know, you really don't need to be smoking, and then they've got a cigarette machine out in the lobby. Or, you know, it would be not necessarily, not having a philosophical grounding. And where is that dangerous? Where that is dangerous is if you have a fund company that is, they've got some funds that aren't stock picking or market timing. They're buying and hanging on to securities. And then they've got some funds that are buying and selling, buying and selling. Now, you may be convinced, as many people have been convinced recently, that stock picking and market timing don't work. Why have people been convinced of that recently? Because the S&P 500, you literally have 20% of the portfolio and like four companies. And those four companies happen to be the ones that happened to have benefited from what happened to have been the scenario over the past year and a half, which is COVID. Now, all of a sudden, let's say that this changes and you have a fund that's actively managed that just so happens to have less value stocks than the index or more small companies. It has more value stocks, excuse me, than the index, or it has more small companies. And now those small companies, those value companies outperform growth companies. What takeaway will people have? Oh, indexing is stupid. I shouldn't be doing this. And a fund company that is selling you both methods of managing money, we go, we have actively managed funds. You can just move your money over here. And now all of a sudden, it's whatever you will do, we can provide for you. And we will provide, or they'll change. People say, I'm managing my own money. And I go, oh, really? Who's choosing the stocks? The fund company. Right. Exactly. You're never really managing your own money when it gets down to it. So having a fund company that philosophically is grounded in one philosophy that they do not veer from because it's convenient or because it sells or because they can retain you as a client is a huge deal, in my humble opinion.
All right. Let's change gears now.
Okay, so just why, you know, selecting various fund companies and just my philosophy in choosing fund companies, because literally we have no restrictions. Some of these fund companies like Vanguard and Fidelity, which are huge. And what is it that's going on inside my head when I go, I'm not using these fund companies? People, well, why not? And they're low cost. Well, in a lot of ways, cost is, yes, it's very, very important, but it can be problematic if the portfolios aren't managed in a way that meets with academic standards, which is multi-factor. What is multi-factor? Well, just to reiterate, when I look at small companies, 83% of 20-year periods, small companies have a higher return than large companies do. So a factor of investing, and if you look at the United States, you look at Australia, you look at Japan, you look at France, you look at Germany, small companies routinely, when the research was done, small companies had higher returns than large companies. And when the research was done, they said, oh, this is robust and it's consistent. And robust meaning we got lots of data, number one, and consistent meaning it doesn't just happen in the United States, it happens in other areas around the world. Okay, so that's very important when you're looking at data. You know, it can't be just isolated to one country. Now, if you look at value companies versus growth companies, same thing, robust and consistent. Persistence with the data in different areas is very, very high. 96% of 20-year periods valued has a higher return than growth stocks do. Why? Because value companies are more distressed and they have to pay more to use your money. It's pretty easy. So if we look at that and we would say, well, how do we know something's value? What do we look at? What data? We look at price to book value. Now, sometimes people will look at what's a value fund. And I go, no, value is a word. And sometimes it connotes undervalued. So fund companies will use that because they believe they can find stocks that are under what they're truly should be valued at, that they're selling for less than what they should be. Hence, they're picking stocks they think are going to do better in the market. Now, if you look at that and you say, well, you got price to earnings too. Well, price to earnings can be very, very, that can be problematic, trying to determine value based on your price that you're paying for the stock compared to earnings. Why? I mean, why is it that earnings? Because earnings fluctuate. I can have a good earnings quarter, really, really good earnings quarter. That's not likely to happen next quarter. And now my earnings are high compared to my price, and I look like it's a value fund. Oh, or a value stock. No, it's not. It's a growth company that just happened to have earnings that were really hot. You know, so, and it's that you have a low price compared to your earnings. That's why if those earnings are high, it looks like a value. That's if you're confused at what I'm saying. But that's why. So you look at, oh, well, okay, so that's not going to help me, but that's one of the criteria that is often used by these big these ratings companies, who shall remain nameless. I was like, Paul, just keep your mouth shut. But they do. They'll rate stuff and they'll classify it, and I'll go, that's not a value fund. Now, case in point, if you look at what is actually classified, I got to say, it's Morningstar. I love Morningstar, but I'm just going to say it anyway because you can't not say it because this is where the data came from. But I do love Morningstar as a gatherer of data. I don't like the ratings and classification scales necessarily. Vanguard, if you look at their small value funds, Vanguard's average small value fund as classified by Morningstar has a turnover ratio of 37%, 85% for Fidelity. That's a lot of buying and selling. That's literally almost every stock changed in the course of a calendar year. Now, if you look at the price of the stocks compared to book value, which is my criteria that I want to use, Vanguard's at 1.72, Fidelity at 1.78. It's pretty high compared to what I would consider value right now at 1.29. That's a pretty doggone big difference, really big difference. You know, so you look at that and it's, 50 basis points, 50 to 60 basis points, you know, so in English, 0.6, 0.5, a dollar, if you look at a dollar as being 100 basis points, 50 cents more, which is literally like, a third to, 50% higher. I mean, it's really, really pretty significantly different. So you look at that, these companies are much higher priced, which gives you less room for them to grow, is really the issue. Large value, 262 versus 207 for what I would be looking for Vanguard versus what I'd be looking for in what I would consider to be true value. And 83% turnover in that area of the market for Fidelity. So it's in essence a philosophical difference in how to approach managing money, number one. But it's also that a fund company does not... It's really hard as even an investment advisor to remain disciplined, because it is, they'll be constantly, when Ira and I were both in that field, in that working for a broker dealer, it was constant. They were constantly coming at us and going, you really need to be recommending this. This performance has been, I remember getting in the business and them saying to me, hey, Paul, congratulations, you passed your securities exam. And now we're going to give you some advice. As the older, and these guys are in their 60s, they've been in the business a long time. You need to forget U.S. stocks in the portfolio. Just put the money in international stocks. And, anything you would have seen out there in the media about international stocks, you knew Japan was eating the United States' lunch. When it came to manufacturing, when it came to processes, when it came to quality, in every instance, Japan was doing better than the United States. And you could, as a financial advisor, come to the conclusion that it made no sense to own U.S. stocks. You would have been dead wrong, because the next decade, right, Ira?
Yep.
I mean, it wasn't even close. And yet... that is exactly what happened to investors in the late 90s.
Late 90s, saw the same thing, just by large U.S. technology companies.
It's all you need to be successful.
Right. I had clients saying to me, I want to get out of the smoke and mortar, the Johnson & Johnsons, the Procter & Gambles.
Mm-hmm. The smoke just and get mortar. Me like the smokestacks and then their brick and mortar.
Right.
Right.
But just get me out of those. And it's a new economy and we're in a new paradigm. No, we're not in a new paradigm, people. We're not.
Yeah, I had that thing I talked about in a previous show where I was actually walking through the only five funds that you need to be successful. And it was literally just five funds that all owned large U.S. stocks. Mm-hmm. And it was just absolute lunacy. Hey, this is Paul Winkler. Hope you enjoyed today's edition of the Investor Coaching Show. If you want to learn more about what we do, go to our website, paulwinkler.com. You can watch some of the videos there. And if you're not already a client, you can set up a free initial consultation. Until next time, I'm Paul Winkler, reminding you that I believe that more educated investors are more confident investors. And confident investors are more successful investors. Have a great one.